We play an ugly game.
I want winners. I want people that want to win.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game.
Welcome back to House of the Dragon 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week we are re-airing our coverage of The Second of His Name. This is episode 3 of season 1 of House of the Dragon. After my interview with Steve, I interview linguist David Peterson. David is the inventor of High Valyrian, and that means, de facto, he writes a lot of the dialogue for this show. If you want to hear more nonsense from Steve and myself, check us out over at Properly Howard, wherever you download podcasts. So, Steve, if you had 24-hour access to a minstrel, what would be on your playlist?
So, he's a minstrel, so he's got limited...
He only knows the one instrument.
The instrument that, like, we felt like we could make.
He knows every song, but he has to pluck away at his little minstrel guitar.
Yeah, it's like he made it out of, like, a stick, a Folgers can, and some rubber bands.
Yeah, that's right. What would you have him play?
I think that I would really enjoy his version of Enter Sandman.
Okay.
I would probably have him do probably some Fleetwood Mac.
That's interesting. I like the Enter Sandman thing because recently we watched sort of a unplugged version of Black Hole Sun.
Yeah.
And it was gorgeous. It was just beautiful.
Yeah, I got to see that live.
Oh, that man, just an amazing song. I mean, I think that the video is sort of seared in my brain, but
sure,
that was great. So I think what Rhaenyra is trying to do is she wants to enjoy him struggling. Like, I think she's getting a lot of pleasure out of it. And if I was going to take that tact, I think a song that I would enjoy over and over again, but also sort of sadistically enjoy him struggling, Peter Gabriel's Shock the Monkey.
Oh, that would be a good one. And then you're just like, do the part where you yell monkey again.
Because I do get the sense that it's one song over and over.
Yeah, so I just saw it as I don't care if it's modern teenager or teenager in Westeros. They're going to just play one song over and over and over again until they get sick of it.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. No, I did get the sense that she doesn't really like the song. She likes to watch him struggle.
this is the power that she imagined she would one day wield as queen.
Yeah. She's got she really has no power over anything her father does anymore. Mm-hmm. So she's decided. Are you eating ice cream? Is that what's happening here? You're eating ice cream while we're podcasting?
No, it was a protein shake. It's all gone now.
Oh, all right. Because I was going to say, it's a little early for ice cream.
It's Labor Day.
That's true.
You know what? I'm no longer going to be respectful to the podcast. There, now it's done.
I'm a little judgy. I feel a little judgy right now, but...
Oh, no, yeah.
I feel like it's justified.
You're like, why didn't you finish your shake before vodka?
No, I just thought it was early in the day for ice cream. I didn't know it was a protein shake. If you were eating ice cream early in the day, I feel like you would want me to be a good friend and kind of judge you over it.
I don't know, man. I feel like ice cream is no different than having like a bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch or something.
Oh, yeah, no, you can't do that. Dude, you're in your 40s.
It's true.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
It's the 40th anniversary of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom this week. And while the movie might be old enough to belong in a museum, our podcast is brand new. So join us for a conversation on the third or fourth best Indiana Jones movie, depending on who you ask, this Wednesday.
And if retro adventure movies aren't your thing, well, maybe you'll enjoy a time warp in the form of a prequel with the theatrical release of Furiosa. Flashback with us to a time when Charlize Theron looked like Anna Taylor-Joy. And strap in for another epic George Miller action movie this Thursday on Bald Move Pulp.
And finally, we're wrapping up our four-week coverage of the 1980 TV miniseries Shogun. Get the final verdict on Yabu, JB, Mariko, and the rest of the gang this Thursday on Bald Move Prestige.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
All right, I've identified four storylines, Steve. The first one I've identified as the toddler Targ. While the king dotes over his tow-headed blonde son, Otto and his brother scheme. Hobert Hightower presses Otto to name Aegon the new heir. After being hectored by Tywin Lannister, Viserys demands to know where his daughter is. Later at the hunt, Otto tells the king that a white hart has been tracked. Because the white stag is a symbol of royalty, he suggests maybe the gods are endorsing the Targaryen toddler. After the hunt, Otto presses Alicent to get the king to name the baby heir. The king and princess argue. She accuses him of trying to set her aside for his new son. He tells her she must marry, she can choose, but he promises not to supplant her. I'm kind of feeling that Alicent has been mistreated. I feel like everyone else is like making decisions and making her life hard, but it's hard for me to try to fault Alicent for any decision she's made so far.
How do you feel about the Alicent-Rhaenyra dynamic, though, when she's summoning her? I mean, they were best friends, man. And now she's stepmom, potentially
right.
Popping out replacements.
Okay. I could see Rhaenyra being angry for a few months. This is supposed to be 3 years later.
Yeah.
I get the sense that Alicent has been trying to make up. And Rhaenyra is just not having it. I feel like this is like an Italian level grudge she's holding against her former best friend.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm on Team Alicent. I'm declaring myself for Team Alicent.
Okay. I mean, I don't feel like I have enough data because it won't matter because we're going to time jump another, 4 or 5 years. I mean, how long are we doing this?
Let me ask you that. How are you feeling about these time jumps?
So, we're 3 episodes in, and we've already seen 2 time jumps, and they're getting longer as we go.
I would even say 3 because the very first episode.
Oh right,
start with like 9 years prior.
Right, right.
That's so you had that 9-year time jump, and then the next 2 episodes were either months or years ahead. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I don't know. I kind of feel like maybe they've done this once too often.
Well, and we know that there's another time jump coming, at least one.
Oh, because they gotta age up these actors, right?
Right. So that's the other part. Is like I had already kind of braced myself for a time jump, but I didn't realize that was going to keep happening. And
here's the thing: they can do whatever they want. They really could. They could play with the timeline if they felt like telling the story would be helped by playing a little bit with the timeline. They could do it. What they've chosen to do is sort of jump ahead every episode, either months or years. And we know at least one more is coming. But I don't know.
But to your kind of earlier point, and brings up the questions like, so yeah, 3 years? 3 years?
Yeah.
Rhaenyra and Alicent are sort of doing this dynamic? Is there more to it? Like, because when you drop in 3 years later, like, I can make the connection that, like, oh, this must be really challenging considering everything.
I mean, it's a big castle. Maybe they've just been, like, they've never sort of, like, they've never, like, bumped into each other at dinner or something.
Yeah, because they're at the the Michael Keaton Bruce Wayne table.
Sure, right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the way that they've done this, it does make you feel like, Rhaenyra, you're going to have to decide either to be miserable or do something else.
Right.
Because this grudge is not helping anyone. That's just my take on it. I still I'm still loving her character. I just feel like it's just a bad look.
Yeah.
There's this scene.
So you're Team Alicent just by virtue of, like, it feels like you feel sorry for Alicent more than you are Team.
Well, here's the thing. I don't just feel sorry for her. There's a scene where Otto comes to her late at night and says, you got to talk some sense into your husband because he's got to name his son heir. He's not going to come to that decision on his own. You have to help him find reason or something like that. And the next day, what she goes out and she does, or maybe it's the same night, she goes and talks to him and gives him really good advice about the stepstones. She's not trying to get her son on the throne so far.
Right.
So she's not entirely her father's creature.
Right. And she may not have as much desire to have her son on the throne because she's.
And it was a pretty good advice. It was kind of like Viserys is worried, like, this is not my war. I didn't choose it. My brother did this, and kind of screw him. And she basically simplifies it. She says, let me ask a simple question. Is it better for the realm for this crab feeder to flourish or be vanquished? Right. And it kind of like really cuts through all the politicking, which he says he feels suffocated by. And I think this is good advice. She's giving him good, not just good advice, but also good political advice.
Well, it's good political advice. And I think it does also help with the undercurrent undercurrent of the themes that the show is dealing with, which is tradition and order versus having to call an audible because you have new information or things have changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the issue at stake here, especially for Rhaenyra and the dynamic obviously between Viserys and everybody at this point, is, well, look, now you have a male heir. Let's just go back. Look, you upset the apple cart because circumstances were what they were. Okay, we didn't love your decision, but I mean, at least it made sense on paper. Now we can go back
mm-hmm.
and do it right. And that's the pressure he's feeling, right? You got to go do the right thing. Do what makes sense and has made sense for centuries. Now, he is taking that, and he's been sort of bucking it a little bit, but he still is, when it comes to this issue, maybe it's a personal vendetta against his brother or whatever, he's kind of pushing towards the sort of the traditional approach of like, I'm not helping, this is not my war. So she comes in and says, okay, that may be true, but there's a new reality.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the best decision now?
Right.
Because that doesn't that sort of feel like that's the undoing of almost any political mission, is the inability to be like, all right, we got to change course for the greater good, or, you know.
Well, and also the inability to change course because you're holding a grudge against your enemies, which should be your allies, right? These Targaryens, they're really holding grudges. It's almost a bit of hubris. It's like this idea that we are so powerful that even if we are at war with each other, our enemies aren't going to swoop in and take advantage. So they're all kind of grudge holders, and they're all a little bit myopic because of it.
Well, this is the White Walker thing, right? I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Interesting
that in this show, the White Walkers is sort of the impending pressures on the Targaryen family from the rest of the realm, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Because they represent, and that's one of the things that, you know, while it was kind of a critique from some, reviewers, is that because it doesn't have that, it doesn't feel as expansive because it's just infighting. Mm-hmm. It still has the same level of intrigue.
Oh, and this episode did a lot to sort of show us the interests, the motives, you know, intricate workings of other families, right? Mm-hmm. You got the two Lannister twins, the strong boys. You know, you got these women who are gossiping at court, you know, Lady Redwine. You started to see a little bit of the wider kingdom at this hunt setting.
Right, and it sort of puts the king and all of his foibles on display for all the houses to see.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
He's weak of... He appears to be weak of spirit and of body, and that's...
This is... Yes, not good for that's anybody. Right. He's a mark. This is why, just to let you know, this is why, as a professor, you never change one bit of the syllabus. The syllabus has to stand as this bedrock concrete document that you've been using for 20 years and cannot be changed because it is the perfect document. The moment you decide to change something on the syllabus, the entire class smells a little bit of blood. And they start circling because if that bit can be chipped away, oh man, we're just going to start tearing this thing to shreds until we get the contract we want. And so I've learned the hard way. You never change the syllabus. This is what Viserys got wrong. He decided to change the syllabus. It said that Daemon was his heir. And as soon as he decided to change the syllabus, this is the kingdom syllabus in this case, the whole realm thought, well, if he can just change his mind, we could change his mind again.
Right. Well, and this is goes back to, I think, what we were talking about with Alicent, is that you can't have it both ways. You can't call the audible. You can't change the path and then go, okay, but we're still going to do everything the same way, except for this one deviation.
Sure.
You have to be willing to deviate. But if you're a leader, you call that deviation. Get new information, make a decision, but he can't seem to do that, right?
Yeah,
he could do it every so often or almost as a protest.
Sure.
He doesn't, you know, even coming to the Rhaenyra appointment didn't feel like it came from a place of like, yeah, I've thought long and hard over this. It was kind of like, I've just sort of being beat down and I'm tired of people telling me what to do. I'll make a decision whether it's the best one or not.
Yeah.
But then you have to live with it.
Right.
And the reason why she's not talking to him and because there's just too much ambiguity. Because he is wavering and he admits as much, but it's like wavering's fine, but you gotta do something.
Well, that's the other thing about this king is that he wants to be liked. You know, right. He says at one point in the episode, he's like, I am forever doomed to make one person angry to make another person happy. So it's really weighing on him. Like, he really wants his 17-year-old daughter to like him.
Right.
And as I'm a father of a daughter, and I want her to like me too. But there's a point in which you have to be a father, even if it sort of might result in, you know, making an unlikable choice.
Heavy is the head that wears the wig. We've said it before.
All right. Storyline two. This is Rhaenyra frolics with woodland creatures. Rhaenyra abuses a poor minstrel while she reads in the godswood. Alicent tries to rekindle her friendship with Rhaenyra to no avail. The princess is carted to the king's wood in the royal procession and pouts. The princess is goaded by Lady Redwine and her cake-eating dog. Then she suffers a half-assed attempt at romance by Jason Lannister. Rhaenyra confronts her father about matchmaking, gets yelled at, and rides off. Kristen Cole pursues, and they have a little adventure in the woods. They kill a boar together. The next day, they have an encounter with the White Hart, but they choose not to kill it. And she returns to camp, all sorts of badass bloody. I was getting a little wrong burgundy energy from Jason Lannister.
I'm kind of a big deal.
His whole attempt was, I'm kind of a big deal.
I love it.
And I don't know if, do you remember the beginning of Austin Powers where Will Ferrell falls into the pit and he's not killed by the fall?
Oh, he keeps staying alive, yeah.
I kind of got that energy of that first Valyrian sailor who was just talking smack to the crab eater.
That was so funny. So is that our first and our only like moment of levity, and it had to come at the expense of somebody getting just completely trampled by a dragon?
It was a little Godzilla, wasn't it?
Right.
It was definitely funny. There was a couple funny elements of this in this episode for sure.
Still not a lot of levity though, right? I mean, like there's moments.
There's dark humor for sure.
Right.
Nothing like the first show for sure.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit more about Jason Lannister. So we got the Lannisters back in our life, and it is twin Lannisters before. I don't know what these guys do in the bedroom, but they are twin Lannisters.
Yes.
And one of them is, according to the other, rather dull. And one of them is like full on Ron Burgundy. How are you feeling about these guys?
I like this addition, and I think again there is a certain amount of smarm that we've been missing, right? So like we're not maybe getting the levity that we want, but like there needs to be some smarm. And I think if you're gonna give me smarm in Westeros, it better have Lannister sigil attached.
It's definitely Lannister DNA on this.
Yeah, yeah.
He just gives off this sense this would have worked on any other woman in the kingdom. He's got his sort of approach, and it works 100% of the time, always.
Yeah, that's right. It's a Sex Panther is his wine.
This is the Sex Panther moment, right? So he goes up to her, and she's just like a little bit amused by him, a little bit taken aback, but a little bit amused. When she sort of dismisses him and walks away, he like huffs like this has never happened to me before. I thought it was a great scene.
Yeah, I like a little bit of a Lannister fit.
All right, so there's this one little line that she says while she's in the cart with her father, and he's basically saying, hey, it's a hunt, come on out, come ride out with me, it's a hunt. And she says, no one's here for me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really interesting way to kind of show she's a little bit spoiled, right? She, you know,
sure.
You know, why should I go to a party if it's not for me?
Right.
But then also, I didn't know how to read Viserys in that moment, because one way to read it is that he's thinking, oh, I think she wants to have someone show her some attention. Maybe I'll try to use this opportunity to match her with Lannister Lord number one. Or was he thinking, yeah, actually someone is here for you. And you're gonna be happily surprised that this guy is showing you attention.
I think it was a little more planned. I think it was the latter.
Okay, I think that's where I landed too. So he's been planning to set her up with this guy then.
Yeah.
At least that's how we're reading it now. There was that one little moment where Jason Lannister's looking at Rhaenyra, like ogling her a little bit, and the king doesn't look very happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I could just be like, I gotta make her happy somehow. I'm not happy with the guy, but maybe she'll be happy with the guy.
Well, and that's the interesting thing about Viserys is that I just don't think he likes this gig. You know, I mean, he's not great at it.
He hates being king, and he sucks at it.
And so he has to make these decisions that go against maybe his own interest or his own hearts and desire, because he knows, like, that's the whole thing. And she calls him on it later, which I think it might be my favorite part of the whole show or this episode, is when she basically says that, you know, choosing Alicent didn't move the needle, right? It didn't.
Yeah, if marriage is all about duty, then why didn't you marry Lena?
Right. So he took the advice, that really shows, I think, the heart of this 3-year spat is, I gave you advice, you took the advice, but then you twisted the advice and you decided, oh, well, then I'm just going to marry for, you chose to marry for love,
uh-huh.
But it turns out to be my best friend. And then now it's, look at what it's yielded. It's and to some degree it was, I don't have a relationship with my best friend because of you, and there's no duty attached to it. And if you're not going to name the son as the heir, then there's even less duty to it. So I don't want to lose my position, but if I at least lost my position, then we could start pointing to duty. But you're doing none of that. So like every decision he's making...
And he owns it. He's willing to say, yeah, you're right. You got a point. Yeah.
Right. And I just think that's such a... And that is a fascinating dynamic too. The fact that he does own it, and he owns it with her, and I mean, he is in some ways he's a better father than a king, but he's still a bad father.
Because I think again we were talking before in a previous episode about doing the right thing as a human sometimes is the exact opposite of what the right thing as a king to do,
mm-hmm.
And you do get the sense that like he's just it's just a really basic human emotion to want to have a good relationship with your children. But here we have a king who's like, he's almost willing to make a bad decision for thousands of people in the realm to make his daughter happy.
Right. And then on the flip side of it, from a larger perspective, it's like, sure, you can upset the typical order of things and you can have a woman on the Iron Throne. That would be, you know, that's arguably something that would be greater for, it's for the greater good, you know, much larger picture. Like, I mean, there's big picture, right? And then, but then there's the bigger picture for Westeros in perpetuity, right? That says, okay, what if we upset the culture? What if we changed the dynamic and we weren't slaves to tradition? That's a bold and arguably noble and maybe a better leadership move for a king to make, to not be looking at just the houses today, but the houses tomorrow. But he's not doing that. I mean, his end may be that, or at least that's what it looks like, but that's not the reason. He's not leading that way. He's leading he's created a massive big picture culture shift for a very myopic reason. And I think that adds to the fascination of this whole dynamic, is that you, as a king, you can set this path in motion, but you've got to sell out to it. But if you don't know if you're not really beholden to the rationale behind it, then you don't know where this is going. It's just
he kind of presents as someone who is always second guessing himself. I mean, that actually, this is a big episode for him second guessing himself, right?
Right.
You want to convey a sense as a king that you do what's right. And so you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it, and you stand by the decision. It's not the best way to be in the world, but it is sort of the only way to be as a king and not exhibit weakness, right? So,
yeah. And it sort of feels like the ultimate critique of patriarchy is patriarchy exists because men are lazy and can't get real creative, so it's just easier to do nothing.
Well, and I think that goes back to sort of his decision to make her his heir because. He's the only one, it seems, that thinks that this is a good idea.
Right.
Like, everyone else is like, dude, you got a son now. What are you waiting for? You changed your mind once with an heir, change it again, you put your son on the throne. Nope. I'm going to do what I think is right. I'm going to put my daughter on the throne. I don't care what anyone else thinks. You can kind of just feel like the shark circling, right?
Right. Well, it's also because there's a 3-year gap of him reaffirming this commitment. It shows,
yeah,
right. I mean, he has a male heir a couple years ago, right? And even if you're having a year of tension, you could make the declaration. You could say nothing has changed. You could be putting Rhaenyra out there as the rightful heir, as opposed to sort of an ornament to or something to sort of marry off. This clearly. The issue was he never reaffirmed it, and people knew that. I mean, it's been explicitly stated, and that's what's happened in this entire episode. So if all these other houses know it, then of course Rhaenyra knows it. And so, not only are we dealing with somebody who's a child, so let's be clear about that. So she's not exactly, while she may show levels of maturity and leadership at an early age, it still is at an early age, not fully fleshed out, and so you can't expect her to be. You're going to need to reaffirm. You're going to need to make that clear. And without that, you've got this. There's this gap. Not only, like you said, the sharks aren't just circling from other houses. I mean, it's at home too. I mean,
mm-hmm. There is this scene with her and Kristen that they're sort of arguing in the woods, and they're not arguing so much as they're just discussing in the woods. About the burden of royalty. You know, she's talking about how hard it is to be princess.
Right.
And Kristen's like, there's tons of people in this kingdom that would happily switch places with you. You almost get the sense with her that she feels like she can never do anything she wants. But from her father's perspective, it's like, all you ever do is what you want.
Right.
It's just this classic teenage daughter kind of thing.
It is, and also let's consider what her model of royalty is, like what her model of leadership looks like. He's got no poker face. I mean, it's clear that he feels this burden of having no agency. So it's sort of,
she's finally at that stage where she's realized that she's smarter than her dad.
Right, and then she realizes if I outsmart him, then I get to be in this role and I get to have no agency again.
I think we both have daughters that have realized that. Like, at some point, yeah. They're like, oh, crap, I thought this guy was pretty good until I realized he's kind of a big dummy.
Yeah, I think it was fourth day dropping her off at kindergarten. I knew everything changed.
she starts looking at you with those, you know what?
She's just like, so
not why sure you know what you're doing, old man.
She's like, so you don't know how to drive a stick shift or you just prefer an automatic? And I was like, just go to school.
So Kristen's like, yeah, I had some fun in my youth, and then, I could have married a common girl, decided to do something else with my life, and here I am. And she's a little bit jealous of him. She's like, man, it'd be nice to make a choice in my life and have it stick. And I do feel like he's a little bit more mature, right? He's like, you have no idea how good you have it.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of a voice within... within the world, but outside of it, which helps.
Okay, so at the end of this episode, Viserys tells his daughter she's got to get married. She can go find her own husband. This seems like it has all the signs of, like, I'm going to marry the wrong guy.
Right.
And I might just do it to spite you, kind of.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess Sir Criston might be a front runner for this. What do you think?
It feels like it, right? But it almost feels too much like it.
He would have to, he's taken vows of celibacy, so he would have to forsake those.
Right.
So would that feel naughty enough to make it attractive?
Yeah, I just feel like, I mean, we're into Game of Thrones, and we're only episode 3,
mm-hmm.
but we're due for a major death.
Oh, interesting.
So he feels like he has no narrative armor as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. All right. So you're thinking maybe he doesn't stick around very long.
Right.
But I feel like she's going to use these words against him. He said you can go out and find your own guy.
Mm-hmm.
And she can almost have anyone in the kingdom.
Yeah. I mean, her options are, you know, one of the HGTV Lannister twins or Clubfoot.
I like that they're bringing in these strong boys. I do like, I'm starting to really appreciate the whole strong family. I feel like Lionel's strong. I feel like this guy, let me ask you this question. All right. So he presents as smart and soft spoken, right?
Mm-hmm.
He gives good advice, seemingly, although some of his advice is to marry off the king to a 12-year-old.
Right.
But politically speaking, he's smart.
Yeah.
So, and he doesn't seem that ambitious so far.
Right.
And so then the question is, should I be rooting for Lionel Strong, or should this make me suspicious?
I just go suspicious. I mean, I don't know.
You're full on Game of Thrones mode at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be weird if it wasn't, right?
Yeah, but I kind of feel like I need someone.
Right, because you can't really trust Otto to be like, well, why don't you just have her marry her little baby brother?
Oh, Otto just gets more and more evil.
Yeah, Otto showed his whole ass this episode.
How about that 2-year-old? How about your strapping young son who's all of 2 years old?
I mean, he's two, but I'm telling you, from here, he looks like 3, 3.5.
That guy is hung like a horse. I've seen it.
It doesn't. It skips a generation. You know what I mean?
So, all right, this brings us to storyline 4. Viserys gets drunk. Viserys is giving off sad dad energy to everyone. He decides he's going to get stupid drunk at the hunt and gets annoyed with Jason Lannister and Otto Hightower for their proposals. For the second time, Lord Strong suggests a marriage alliance, and this time between Rhaenyra and Lenor. Later on, by the fire, Viserys confesses to Alicent that he thought his dreams were prophetic, and he allowed himself to be guided by them. This obsession killed his first wife and resulted in a second wife. Now he's doubting his faith. The next day, he sucks at killing a CGI stag. The stag was... Like, they're doing... bang-up work with the dragons, for sure, man.
Stags are hard, dude.
It's like they got the dragons down. They're like, for some reason, we just can't crack this stag.
Yeah. Well, you know how it is? Like I was pretty good at drawing, like, a horse.
Sure.
But I could not draw a car. The doors were always in the wrong spot.
You draw the doors and then the windows second.
I'm a 46-year-old man and all my cars look like I drew them with my left hand and I'm 4. And you know what? I see cars all the time. But my brain's like, I think every day I drive a refrigerator box with square wheels.
Yeah, the stag, it was an interesting problem. I was absolutely taken out. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard one because I kind of expect it. Uh-huh. And there were moments like sort of like distant when it was in motion, like my brain was kind of like, okay, this, like don't. Mm-hmm. And then it was, oh, okay. And I don't know how else to get around that, right? I mean.
Well, okay, let me ask you this question. How'd you feel about the boar?
I felt okay with the boar.
Yeah, the boar was fine. I mean, I kind of knew that it was CGI, but for whatever reason, maybe because it was like going fast or something.
Yeah.
I was totally fine with it. And then...
Well, I think a boar doesn't have as much, like, neck movement and whatnot. So when a boar moves, it's like watching a rugby ball get thrown. Sure. You know, because it's just... Because there's not a lot of, like... It's not, like... Which is interesting about a dragon, how sinewy and serpentine it can be. But I think that might help because it's because of how much motion it's going in. Whereas the stag, you also have an expectation of how it's going to move.
You know what? I think I got this figured out. So you've got these CGI digital artists, right? And they're all really talented, right? But if you got put on stag duty, like all your best friends got dragon duty.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Oh, geez, you give me stag. Like, you're not into it. You don't have your heart into it.
Oh, yeah. I remember when like they were handing out reports and like if you get stuck with something in the wrong, like, lap.
Oh, man. They half-assed the stag because... Uh-huh. If you got stag duty, that was almost an insult.
Yeah.
So you're like taking long lunches. You're going home early.
When I was in elementary school, and every once in a while we'd have like music time.
Sure.
And then the box of instruments would come out. And we were not a wealthy school by any stretch.
Did you have like an egg shaker in there?
Oh, there was an egg shaker. There was the triangle.
What about the tambourine? Tambourine?
There was a tambourine. There was a stick with like little tiny little cymbals on it.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
That was the pearl of great price, right? I mean, that was like the one. And like... And it was all about where you were going to sit and where they started with the box. Cause you're just like, man, if I get the frickin' triangle and you know, it's like, yeah, I'll do my best. You know, what's my job here? Like, what's my role? Everybody else is like keeping the rhythm. Like, nobody wants you to constantly keep the rhythm with the triangle. The triangle comes in and like makes a cameo, you know? So you better believe I'm going to miss my cue if I'm triangle boy. That's stag duty.
And it sounds like you had to be triangle boy for a little bit.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like jury duty, right? Everybody has to have their time with the triangle. No one's taking triangle's not going top three picks in the draft, right? Just never.
I have no idea how we got here. I do like the idea that Viserys was a man of faith before,
right?
Of course, the faith was sort of in his own sense of prophetic ability. And you almost get the sense, like, I finally understand why he's not that impressed with the dragons. He's always been a little dragon dubious. And he felt like, I thought I was a dreamer. I thought I had these prophetic dreams. And that's really what I cared about. And I lived my whole life following this and obsessing over it and thinking that it was going to make me special. And then when it didn't work out the way I thought it would, everything kind of fell apart. Because he really does present as someone with lost faith.
Yeah. But it also questioned, you know, because of what we know about Viserys, it's like, how deep was that faith, right? Like, it was the faith only as good as it was when it validated your own, you know, hopes?
Well, I mean, he followed what he thought was prophecy, and it resulted in his wife's death. I mean, that's a wake-up alarm for sure, right?
Yeah, I guess that would do it. I'd probably go to less Sunday services.
Anyway, he's starting to make more sense to me. Because I was always a little bit like, what do you mean you don't like dragons? Like, what do you mean that the dragons are... You're a Targaryen king, man. Like, the dragons are where your power resides. You can't be... so nonchalant about these dragons. But now I kind of get it. It's like, oh no, Targaryens are also known for their prophetic dreams, and that's where he thought he would find a little niche.
Right. Yeah, I guess that works. I mean, and again, as a man who is like lost faith or losing faith, now he has to, I mean, if you're a religious person or a spiritual person, I mean, you defer to the hierarchy of the gods or God. And if that proves to be folly, if that proves to be something that like, oh, that was all happenstance, you're not accustomed to making these types of decisions because you've deferred.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like he was sort of rock solid in his faith. And then when he lost it, he kind of lost the ability to make decisions for himself.
Right, because now it's like, okay, well, no, the whole time I've got to do this. There's like, who do I go to? Do I go to the Council of Man? I don't trust that, and I can't go to a higher power. And now it's up to me, and it's just like, that's where I think we're getting this sort of like freeform jazz approach to leadership.
Well, it's also interesting because the two, like the Targaryens, almost believe that they are close to gods.
Right.
And so the question, so it's not just when he loses faith, it's not like losing faith in a higher power. It's like losing faith in the dynasty, and that in and of itself weakens you.
It's like, yeah, it's like hatching a dragon without wings. It's like, okay, well, it's something, but it's not everything.
All right. Storyline 4. Oh no, I think I skipped a storyline. Somewhere in here. This is called Trouble with Crabs. Kragas Dahar continues to burn and crucify and steal and generally annoy the Valyrian fleet. An especially mouthy Valyrian sailor gets crabbed and then cheers with Daemon shows up on Dragonback. Then he gets stomped. The crab feeder escapes the dragon pretty easily with his innovative hide-in-cave strategy. Meanwhile, back at the King's Landing, the king is pressed to take action. After the hunt, Alicent gets the king to send a letter to Daemon with a promise of ships and soldiers. Meanwhile, at the Stepstones, the battle goes badly for the Blondies. Vaemond questions the value of the alliance with Daemon, but is talked down by his nephew and his brother. Daemon is upset to hear that his brother is sending aid, so he makes one last desperate effort to flesh out the fleshy crab feeder. The battle ends with Daemon cutting Kragas in half. Laenor shows up on his dragon, Sea Smoke. Is it believable these guys got two dragons and they're losing a war to a guy with crabs?
How deep is this cave? It's clearly farther than fire deep.
It's a rhetorical question. I absolutely don't believe that they are losing. They got two dragons with, and they're going up against pirates. Like, a ship can only go so fast, so these guys are hiding in caves, but the caves are on islands.
How are their archers anywhere ever? And I understand that this is like B squad, C squad, stormtrooper level archers, but
yeah, you're right. These archers suck.
Dude, these archers blow.
So this whole thing didn't work for me. I feel like that we finally found a storyline that's not working. And I mean, I guess to a certain extent, maybe they wrapped it up because they cut the guy in half, right?
Yeah.
So maybe I don't have to worry about this going forward. But I do feel like this is a little bit of a concern for me. I just don't believe that this guy can be... Look, you got two dragons. This guy's got crabs. I don't see how this works.
Now, if you have crabs at home and you're listening to this, please understand what we're talking about. We're not saying that you, in your condition, are not an apt fighter.
We're not crab shaming anyone.
Yeah. So, well, and I think part of that is juxtaposed to Game of Thrones, even at its weakest, was always tactically interesting. The war and the battles were logical.
Yeah, and one of the ways that they did that is that they always had the dragons, until later seasons, they always had the dragons have some kind of deficit.
Right.
Right? Like either they were too small or they didn't know how to control them or the dragon left or we gotta shackle up the dragons. Now these guys are supposed to know how to use these dragons.
The height of dragondom.
Yeah, the height of dragondom. And they can't even take down... All right, look, let me put it this way. The first Aegon conquered all of Seven Kingdoms with three dragons. These guys have two dragons. And for 3 years, they're being eluded.
They're fighting Krabby Krueger and his number one, battle plan is hide farther than the fire can reach.
I don't know. I'm not sure if this is... I can't talk myself out of this one. This is pretty...
Yeah, I was trying with that because there was a lot of this that was visually fun. Yeah. but it was also like it still felt a little bit absurd. And so at the end, when he's dragging the the carcass out, it's kind of like, well, that's the end of that.
Yeah, does it feel like this episode? I mean, I really liked all of the hunt part of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I should have been really excited to see Damon be a badass.
Right.
And I got to see Laner show up on his sea smoke dragon, which, you know, new dragon in the house. I just was a little bored by this part of it. And we've talked a bit before about having too much battle in an episode and you get a little battle fatigue.
Yeah.
I did feel like Sapochnik was the guy who did Hard Home and Battle of the Bastards, and I kind of felt like those were amazing. This was not amazing. So I don't know what to think about this.
Yeah, I mean, so the arrows, like, all missing him until the end. I could almost get on board with, like, from the perspective of that type of battle attack with all the archers is probably way more effective on a massive amount of people charging. But when you're when you're trying to aim at one, maybe that's not as good.
It's odd because earlier in the episode, he actually gets shot with an arrow on Dragonback.
Right.
Yeah, and it was like, he really took that one. And then he breaks it off. Maybe that was their way of showing, like, well, people do get hit with arrows sometimes.
Yeah. And it's been happening for 3 years, apparently. Because then when it finally happens, right, when he finally just says, well, I'm just going to bum rush it by myself. And then once I've got them all out of the cave, dragging them. And then bring our bigger army that's much more adept with better steel and everything. You're like, sure does feel like you guys should have. I mean, not like they don't have the numbers, right? I mean, they even have. I mean, like, what would have happened if they just said, let's just go to those caves? Let's just go.
Well, they do that little scene with Corlys earlier where they're like, they try to establish that trying to go into those caves is a little bit of a fool's errand. Like, who would be crazy enough to go into those caves?
Right.
But even so, I kind of...
The dragon can't stick its head in farther?
I don't get it, man.
I mean, couldn't they have been working on, like, a fire cone that would, like be the equivalent of putting your thumb on the end of a hose and to get more, like, power and spray?
Okay, in this world... dragon can like burn stone till it collapses. Like that's how they took down Harrenhal. They basically, you know, Balerion the Black Dread basically burned a castle made of stone. You're telling me that if a dragon doesn't just keep baking the front of that cave, he couldn't collapse it?
Or I don't know. Could you just seal it and just like, okay, you're in a tomb now?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. I didn't hate it. It just didn't work for me. So
yeah. Well, the problem with it more than anything is those thoughts are going through your mind, and it's kind of like when somebody's telling a decent joke, but they've gotten a couple of the tenses wrong, or they make a couple of things. Like as soon as I'm not thinking about as soon as I'm out of the story and I'm thinking about its structure, it almost doesn't matter how it plays out. And so it was, by the time he comes out and he's dragging the half corpse out, I was kind of like, part of me was kind of relieved. Like, all right, well.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about that. So did this guy ever have a line in the show? Because they were almost setting him up as the big baddie.
Right.
Now we're going to see this guy. We're going to find out of his backstory a bit. We're going to find out why he's so formidable an enemy. Clearly formidable enough to have given these guys hell for about 3 years. At the end of the day, no lines, gets Darth Mauled, and then that's it. That's it for him. So does that feel a bit odd to have him exit in that way?
It does. I think the bigger message that was trying to be sent in this whole battle is that, you know, whether or not it was presented in the way that maybe you and I would have enjoyed better, is that the Targaryens may be a little full of themselves. I mean, you know, right? I mean, we're dragons, we're this, we're that. And the thought was, well, no one can really threaten us. I mean, we're not going to spend all this energy and go against a bunch of pirates or this or that. But the reality of it is, you got to want it. And when you have nothing to lose, you become a lot more dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the idea that this is Ewoks taking down, you know, the stormtroopers. I mean, it's don't underestimate your enemy, and it shows a vulnerability that's like, okay, look, this is part of what happens. You know, we talked about if the Targaryens are fighting amongst themselves, then that creates an opening for other houses, and this is a perfect example. Like, this is not the Lannisters. These are pirates, and these aren't even like, you know, cool, sexy pirates. This is Captain Scurvy and the gang, and it's. I mean, so I think that's the old. To me, that's the. I take that overall theme as something to take away from it, regardless of maybe how I feel about the execution. But going back to what we were talking about, and you talked about the, you know, the repertoire that this, you know, director has from battle scenes, and mm-hmm. it does, you know, because again, this show is so damned by the previous one, both good and bad, that it's like, this is your best foot forward. I really am going to want less battle scenes that are more, you know, visually stunning than they are logically.
I think that visually stunning is the right phrase here. I think if I had to guess, I would say that this is a show that's all about conversations in rooms with tapestries. That's kind of what this show's about.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to figure out some way to get us outside. And they did it by taking all of these conversations out into the Kingswood. And then they brought us action through this kind of insignificant storyline. They're trying to use Daemon and Corlys as action heroes in a show that's supposed to be built for House of Cards style politics.
Right. And in a way that a victory of this nature does set things up, and it does politically complicate things, right? And
right.
And yeah, so that's good for the Daemon and Corlys. But I also did take an opportunity to show that there's some infighting between Corlys and family, right? I mean, I think I think it's showing. I mean, there's a lot of good that comes out of this. I just think there's some execution errors.
There's some execution. I want to say one thing that I liked about the storyline that I just thought was great. I like that everyone knows that this war needs support from Viserys. Everyone knows. Everyone in the kingdom knows that this battle is going badly. They need support from the king. And they finally get it. And Daemon is disappointed. He's not just disappointed. He's like pissed off.
Kills the messenger.
He literally tries to kill the messenger. And you kind of get the sense that this guy can't win because he'll never be able to do anything on his own. He's always going to need his brother's help.
Well, and the beauty of that is he doesn't need his brother's help because his brother is smarter or, you know, more talented. Sure. It's that his brother just happens to be on the throne.
Yeah, which should be him, right? In his mind, he was never good at being king. You put me on that throne, all these problems are solved.
So how insulting is it that in order for you to show your worth for the throne, you decide to do this heroic mission that is failing because you don't have access.
It only proves you to be inept, right?
Right. It's... And so when he runs, when he does the fake surrender and he's running in there, I did get the sense that it could go either way for him. Like, and he was okay with it. You know, like I kind of got the sense that I'm either going to come out with half a body or I'm going to leave half a body. And that part I thought was pretty fascinating. And going back to what we talked about in terms of insecurity and how that then makes somebody more, you know, even more menacing. I think that played out pretty well here.
Yeah. Yeah. Here we have this guy who he's got everything, right? He's a champion. He's one of the best knights in the kingdom. He's got a dragon. He's wealthy. And he just can't stand his brother's shadow. It just makes him livid. And so now he's unpredictable. Now this guy is so insecure, he's willing to kill people over it. So,
well, and isn't this such an interesting character too? Because we're all like, he's menacing and kind of terrifying, but he loses more than he wins, it feels like. I mean,
how is this guy losing anything?
And even the joust, man. I mean, he loses.
And, that's right.
And I think that's interesting because they've created this, I guess he's a villain, but it's the Game of Thrones world. Everybody's a little villainous, but he's not Steven Seagal in Under Siege. You know?
No. I'm getting a little bit of Michael Jordan energy off him. It's like Michael Jordan would like create these little slights. He would like create the sort of these narratives about people who had disrespected him.
Right.
So he could kind of fuel his talent. He kind of direct, that was sort of his magic feather. He could like
he needed to create a narrative that no one believed in him, even if he was a 5-time champion going in.
Right. And so it's almost like this guy, it's like Damon's like, he's going to be like so focused on the moment of his loss that he's not going to be able to see all the times he's won.
Right.
You know, compare him with almost any other person in the kingdom. He's a winner. He was born a winner. He's got all the talent. He's got brains. He's got privilege. He's got all this stuff. And he just feels deep down, he just feels like a loser. That's fascinating to me.
So. Right. And clearly this battle against Kragas was his flu game.
This is his flu game for sure. And he needed it. This wouldn't be like losing to Karl Malone. This would be like losing to the Utah Jazz when all they had was John Stockton.
Yeah. Hornacek beat you.
That's a great analogy. All right, we got ourselves a dismemberment count. Now, does it count if it's like if you get cut in half? Because when I think of dismemberment, I feel like you've lost an appendage. But if you get cut down the middle, is that dismemberment?
I feel like that's like a bulk dismemberment, right? That's like that's like a Kirkland signature.
Okay, we're gonna count it. All right, his top half was dismembered from his bottom half, or the other way around. And then we have Cheekspeak.
Whoa, I mean that's back to back.
Back to back zeros. We were both wrong. We both said 5 and took the over, right?
Yeah.
So we're both totally wrong on that one. And then
do we have an over under for Cheekspeak going into the next one?
Oh, that's a good point. It's a good point.
I'm going to hold it at 5 because I think we're way overdue.
I'm a little stumped. I'm going to go under.
Okay.
I feel like you could be right. We could have an explosion of cheeks.
That's right. It's just, yeah,
this will be the Eyes Wide Shut episode of House of the Dragon. Yeah, I'll go under. So 5 or over, you win. Under 5, I win.
4.5 and under, you win.
4.5 and under, I win. And then finally, would you call this a Dinklage, a Danny, or a Dorne in terms of ranking?
I'm going to give this a Danny -1.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to say this is our first Dorne.
Okay.
Because I was going to say, I was almost going to say like Dorne +1 or Dorne +2. I love the hunt. The Stepstone stuff just didn't work for me at all. So.
Yeah, initially I was going to go Danny -2 to flirt with the Dorne territory. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think I didn't want to put too much weight in the Stepstones. Some of the issues I had with it just because it was the last thing we saw, because I think there was so much good stuff in the hunt.
Yeah.
And I feel like my audience relationship with Viserys is so much more interesting than I thought it was going to be, and it's super rich.
He's so good. Paddy Considine is so amazing.
He's blowing me away, and I feel like, so the thing is, so that's why I'm like, it wasn't, I can't Dorn it.
Okay.
I have to look back at my Dorns and go, I know how I felt with the Dorn.
it's a good point. It's a good, because he's amazing. But it's almost like he's being killed with 1,000 paper cuts, this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like he's being annoyed to death.
Right. Well, that's
hard to kind of pull off. Like, you're so annoyed that you're, like, you're just exhausted by being so annoyed all of the time. But you do really get the sense that you really feel for him in this episode.
Well, because the odd thing is, I do feel like deep down there might be actually a great king in there because he doesn't want to be king.
Yeah, sure.
And I think we talked about that on the rewatch of Game of Thrones. Like, who's best to rule is the one that maybe makes the least sense to do so.
It's interesting. I was thinking, like, who would be the best ruler in this kingdom? I think it might be Rhaenyra if you gave her Lionel Strong as her hand.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Because she's got all the confidence that her father doesn't have. And she's arrogant. I think you need to be a little bit arrogant as a king, right? And then, I mean, she's a bit immature, but if you could give her someone like Lionel Strong... If there's anyone I'm rooting for in the show, it's him. Presenting as wise, soft-spoken, not ambitious. How do I not root for this guy? So we'll see. We'll see. Hey, I feel a little bit... So Lady Redwine is the woman who had the little fat dog who was eating cake.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I was getting a little Steve Osborne energy off her.
Because of the dog, or?
Well, if you think about what she's doing, like, she's sitting around gossiping.
Mm-hmm.
She's got opinions on how things should be run. She's enjoying the food.
Oh, yeah.
And she's got a little dog.
Yeah. I feel like maybe I'm a little more Lady Redwine than I give myself credit for.
Did you? Now, when you saw the dog, there were a lot of dogs in this episode, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
a lot of dogs. I'm kind of curious to hear. You're a very strong dog guy.
It brought me a great deal of joy.
You like to see all the dogs.
I like to see dogs. I feel like dogs, seeing regular dogs, not CGI dogs or magic dogs, goes a long way for me to be like, to get back to the people part of it.
Sure. I was thinking, because I said I was missing magic in this show. I was missing it again. And I was thinking, you know, it'd be really cool to see like a giant hound. Hound as big as a horse. How about that? Just to make me happy. Just a little something to make me happy.
How about a pug as big as a boar?
Was that Lady Redwine's dog? Was it a pug?
I think so, which does bring up some interesting things about like, breeding history and how we got there, but I'm like, all right, I'll allow it.
Anachronistic to have that dog at that stage in history, right?
Yeah, we had all these wolves before, but now it's like, oh, you know, I mean, before them, there was the pug. That's where the wolf was descended from. It was weird.
I love that we got dragons, and it's the pug breeding that took you out of the episode.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like when people are critiquing the new Lord of the Rings. They're like, you know, I can handle giant eagles that you can fly on and ogres that come from the ground, but a Puerto Rican elf? No, thank you.
So I'm with David Peterson. He's the guy. He's the guy behind all of the languages that you've been watching on almost every screen everywhere. Inventor of the linguistic paradigms and a lot of the vocabulary for High Valyrian. The author of a number of books, including The Art of Language Invention. And you've written a children's book called Create Your Own Secret Language. Is that what it's called?
That's right. And it goes from ciphers, so like the very elementary ciphers, up to elementary language creation, and kind of in a step-by-step way.
I've got a child who's maybe just nerdy enough to appreciate that book. I think, I'm not shining you on, I think I'm going to purchase this as soon as we're done here. It sounds fantastic. So Macmillan, I'm sure, will have that on the website, and I'm sure you could also buy it from other book vendors, well-known book vendors as well, right?
Wherever they may be, I don't yes. know. Like, you never know who's selling books these days. Sure. Where do you even go to buy a book?
So before we jump into linguistic stuff, I'm just kind of curious, how are you enjoying House of the Dragon?
I'm really liking it so far. For those who are listening, at the time of recording, we have cleared episode 3. And I've been enjoying it a lot. I've actually been totally cool with the time skips, which might be jarring a bit for watchers, but I think they're doing a really, really good job with it. The dragons are great. And I'm really appreciating the performances. It's you know, early days of the season where it's like you're figuring out who do I really like here.
Yeah, I think that the first episode I was really, I just couldn't take my eyes off Daemon Targaryen. I just thought this guy is stealing every scene he's in. Yeah. And in more recent episodes, I've really come to appreciate a lot of these other actors. You know, King Viserys is just, I mean, I've never seen someone die from 1,000 paper cuts so convincingly. He's just amazing. As far as the performance of what that actor is accomplishing, I'm just in awe of what he's been able to do. Do you have a favorite character so far?
I have many. But oddly enough, the one that I keep watching is Viserys 2. Because, you know, especially the first episode, you don't really know what he's all about, because at times he seems like such a marshmallow, kind of like the Robert Baratheon, like, fun time king. It's like, hey, everybody just have a good time, man. We got a kingdom here, and it's for fun. They keep throwing stuff yeah. at him. You kind of figure out why he is the way he is.
And
they give him the opportunity, you know, to really show you how he got to where he is. And also, you know, at times, to show his strength and to show you that there is something mm-hmm. else underneath the exterior. And then also at times to show you, it's like, gosh, all this poor guy really wants to do is just play with his model trains, you know?
Well, he wishes that people would just kind of give him a break. And yeah. it's not like he doesn't think his job's important. He's just so over it. And, you know, he does give the sense of like a CEO who is already looking sideways for some way to get out. He's looking for that golden parachute, but there's none to be had. He's going to have this job till he's dead. So, and it might happen sooner than later because the Iron Throne wants to kill him.
That was a nice little tidbit in episode 1. You know, nobody mm-hmm. sits easy on the Iron Throne.
Yeah, yeah.
That's always nice to reinforce.
Okay, we've gone past episode 1, but I do want to talk about a scene in episode 1.
Okay.
It's the scene that kind of hooked me in this show, and it's when Rhaenyra comes in and sees Daemon on the Iron Throne. This key sacrilege, you know, to for anyone but the king to be sitting on that throne, and for her to kind of look at him almost lovingly and with a bit of admiration, because she's a little bit sacrilegious herself. And immediately they drop into High Valyrian, or they code switch, I suppose, into High Valyrian. And all of the sudden, I'm in. I'm not thinking about anything else. I'm in that world. And it was that code switch that really did it for me. It said so much. It was like shorthand for the world building, in a sense that these two have an elite education. They have a shared history together. They're both, from my view, you can correct me, equal levels of of Fluent.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if they are reflecting off each other in a way that no other two characters can in the episode. And I just thought it was a brilliant use of this particular language. If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that scene, I would love to hear you talk about it.
Essentially, Viserys reminds me of the kind of first generation, first or second generation, basically the one whose parent only spoke, you know, Valyrian maybe.
Mm.
And so now Viserys is this guy who is absolutely fluent in Valyrian, but doesn't want you to know it.
He wants his kids to be able to be fluent in the language of the New World, right?
Yes. And they are, but you can see that with that, they're now kind of like not one step, but two steps removed. There's a lot of like third generation kids who are like, wait a minute, we had this whole cool culture and you basically like didn't give it to us. Why?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Now, of course, they're a little different because they are fluent in High Valyrian. So that's cool. Like evidently that was important enough in their household to maintain so that they actually are fluent. But I mean, culturally, you can see like they are more in tune with it. They're more excited by it than somebody like Viserys, who is like, yeah, I know all that stuff, but you know, we're here now. Let's be focused on being here. And so that's just, I think, a really cool kind of level of detail that was added. So yeah, for that scene, I have to say, you know, when I was, jumping back a little bit, when I was first brought onto the show, I was both delighted and surprised because I was a part of two other Game of Thrones prequel series.
Interesting.
One of them was the one that produced the pilot, the Blood Moon one. So that was an interesting experience. You know, I got to use my Children of the Forest language. It got abandoned in Game of Thrones. I got to use it. And then they also had me create an Andalish language because in that setting, the old tongue was going to be represented by English.
And just as a sort of a follow-up question here, did Martin ever give us any Andal vocabulary in any of the works?
Yes. So words like sept, septa, septon.
Okay, this would all be from the Andals. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And of course, what it's just very few because modern Andalish is
the
common tongue, which is English in the series. But this was going to flip it because it was going to be the invasion of the Andals. And so they were going to be represented as the foreigners. And so the old tongue was going to be English. And then the Andal language, they had me create one. And so I did. I created a language that basically could have, you know, plausibly, if you evolved it, sound like modern English. It was a lot of fun. And of course, we produced a pilot and then it was canceled. And I never saw it. So
sure.
Somewhere that pilot exists. And I really wonder if it will ever see the light.
It's in the vault.
No. I mean, yeah. I worked on it, damn it. I want to see what it was. But,
sure.
So there was that. But then I was also associated with the old Valyria prequel, which would have been set in Valyria before the Doom.
Sure.
And I was brought in at a very, very early stage. This is like before even network drafts, because they were talking about like, well, you know, they're all going to be speaking High Valyrian, so we have to do it in English, but, you know, we still want to use the language. We're coming up with a religion. So like, here are some ideas for gods, you know,
yeah.
You give us input on that. Like we were going all into it. And then that was canceled like before the stage where you even got to a pilot.
Got it.
But it's like for both of those projects, I was involved so early that suddenly I see this announcement from HBO that like, you know, House of the Dragon is going to be the next prequel. And I'm like, okay.
That's news to me, right?
it's news to me. And not only that, it sounds like it kind of, you know, really features a lot of people that might be speaking Valyrian and nobody said word one to me.
Right.
And then it's like, it was several months after that, that I finally was contacted and said, you have some Valyrian for you. And I'm like, geez, at this stage, like,
I think I even talked to you at that stage where it's sort of like, We're pretty sure this is going to happen, but no one's actually contacted the guy that's got to write some of the dialogue here. So anyway.
And so then when I was contacted, and then when I saw the level of dialogue that they were going to have me translated, I was kind of like, wow, completely unexpected. And so anyway, all this is to build back up to like, yeah, this is the first scene. And it's like, you should know that when I got the dialogue, I got it all. I think they had everything but episode 110 done at that point. So I had all the dialogue, but it's like, yeah, looking at the first scene, I'm like, this is a significant amount. And so I'm looking at this entire back and forth, and I'm like, my goodness, this entire scene is in High Valyrian. And it's like, you go to like the next episode, she's like, Jesus, look at all this back and forth. And then the episodes that are coming, it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So like, that was something that was really quite unique. Because, you know, while High Valyrian enjoyed a lot of use in Game of Thrones, there wasn't a lot of back and forth. It was mainly Daenerys speaking in High Valyrian. Mm-hmm. Other people kind of like speaking in Astapor or Myrnese Valyrian. And then also a lot of back and forth in Dothraki, depending on the season. And so this was giving me a chance to be like, all right, these are people who are fluent in High Valyrian, who each have their own style.
Mm-hmm.
And so who can make their own active choices about how they want to use the language and would also be used to conversing back and forth in it.
Right. A language almost needs a culture, right? So you almost need someone to speak it with, right? Whereas Dany, like, she would only get rare opportunities to speak it. And I always got the sense that it was, you know, it was quote unquote her mother tongue, but I never got the sense that she was fluent in the way that these characters are. Is that your sense as well?
It's hard to explain it. She would be like, you know, 100% fluent, but not conversational.
Oh, interesting. And maybe it's a reading language for her.
Basically, in the way that, in this way, like when you read something that's been, you know, written. And especially like if you think about like 19th century English for books that were written like that.
Yeah.
They're written, they're fluent, they're written very well. But there's a lot of reflection. It's like on word choice and sentence choice. It's like and it's like structured very beautifully. And just so you don't usually read stuff from that era. That's like, hey, what's up? How you doing? It's like, am I? You know, things like that.
Sure.
And so that's kind of like the component she's missing. So where like she's sounds very formal and stilted. And it's kind of interesting because you can see a little bit of that. It's a little bit further removed, but it's like the very highly educated, you know, the masters and so on of Slaver's Bay. They'll understand High Valyrian, but it's like being lectured by a teacher.
Right. Yeah. I do want to talk about another scene.
Yeah.
All right. It's the scene in the second episode where Rhaenyra shows up dramatically to kind of confront her uncle, who's kind of being an ass. And she basically says that much. She basically gets off the dragon, walks right up to him and says, what are you going to do about this? Because here I am. She establishes that she knows High Valyrian again, and they have a mutual respect. But then, at a crucial moment, she drops out of High Valyrian, code switches back to the common tongue, and it was almost as if that moment was a key transition because she wants everyone to hear that she has called his bluff. And I just thought, what an excellent use of language in this scene. In a way that brings High Valyrian into the world in a way that enhances it and not just sort of like a garnish or something that's superficial. It's sort of integral to the how that scene works.
It's a kind of power play. You see it with language, but it also features in just different things. It's like, you know, there's also the distinction where it's like you're whispering something to somebody. And then it's like when you see it's not going your way, then you just speak very loudly. So suddenly everybody's looking at you. So it's like you can do the same thing in the same language, but it's like when she's in High Valyrian talking to Daemon, it's like, all right, this is just between us, you know, can we work this out? And then it's like, she's all like, you know, so you're having a baby, and he clearly sees it. It's like, well, you know, one day I will. And then she's like, all right, that's it. I said, we're done here.
Okay.
I was going to try to work this out with you, you know.
Yeah. Maybe you could answer this for me. I'm imagining that there are several maesters who will be able to understand High Valyrian. I'm imagining that most Targaryens who are in and around court are some level of fluent with High Valyrian. I'm wondering about someone like Otto Hightower or some of the other folks who are around and listening to the conversation. Like, how many of those people do you think would understand what they're talking about?
That's a good question. The best answer, or I'm sorry, the accurate answer is I don't know. But in truth, like, if, let's say if it were me in court, the best thing that you could do is pretend that it's like, oh, yeah, of course, in my education, I, you know, had a couple of little classes in High Valyrian here and there. And so I don't really speak the language, because in effect, it's to your advantage to be able to understand the language that others are using.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's like with guys like that, it's like, if they do understand High Valyrian, they should never tell anybody about it.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. It's advantageous for someone like Otto to be fluent enough to be able to eavesdrop, but also never reveal that he is eavesdropping, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's effectively the same thing that Daenerys does in Storm of Swords, where it's like, basically, Krasnys has given her an advantage, and she recognizes it immediately,
yes,
assuming that she doesn't speak Valyrian, and she's like, why would I betray this? What advantage does this do me if I can understand him and he thinks I don't?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, no, that's a great... I hadn't thought about that, but it's a great analogy here. So I just got a couple questions for you, just about sort of like how the sausage is made a bit. And so let's just start here. Like, what is your relationship with subtitles? Because I think as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate subtitles a bit more. But it's sort of an interesting choice to use subtitles in a show when you don't have to. And I'm curious about let's say it's not something that you've written. What's your general feeling about watching a show with subtitles?
When you have a lot of back and forth conversation, like a whole scene in it, you absolutely do need it. I think that there are very clever and very masterful ways to not use subtitles. And just a very small way, I've been watching A League of Their Own, and there's two characters who speak Spanish. And for one of them, at one point, they always subtitle what they're saying. But there's a one point in time where she just starts going off and speaking very quickly, and they don't subtitle it. But you understand what's happening in the context of that scene. And it's actually kind of better if you don't.
Just because of the tone of her voice?
Because of the tone of her voice, the situation, you understand what's going on. And so it's better not to have subtitles for that. Sticking with Spanish, I will tell you that one of the best uses of a lack of subtitles that I've ever seen is in a show called Teen Titans. It's extraordinary. The Teen Titans, was the cartoon. It was on Cartoon Network. It had Robin and a bunch of other characters. But there are two characters called Más y Menos, plus and minus, that speak Spanish exclusively. And none of their dialogue is ever subtitled, but it doesn't need to be, because it's done so well with illustrations on screen. You know, it's anime influenced. It's not anime, but it's anime influenced. And so they can do a lot more with expressions and a lot more with like kind of fourth wall breaking, like background illustrations. And so you always understand everything that they're saying, except for like, you know, a scene where like maybe they're arguing with each other and you're not supposed to understand, but you see that they're arguing. So I think it's really, really wonderful for kind of immersive learning.
Yes.
Something like that has to be constructed just so.
Yeah.
It's not many productions that can do something like that. But when it's done and when it's done well, it's so wonderful.
So, okay. I mean, I just know a little bit of Spanish. I don't know it well enough to be able to say, oh, that was absolutely an error. But every now and again, you'll hear something spoken in Spanish and you'll realize, oh, the subtitle didn't actually match what the person just said. And okay, so
that actually, I mean, that happens in my work too.
Oh, really? Okay. Give me an example of something like that.
I mean, like, it happens all the time. So let's see. Like, you know, it was like there's this line in episode 2 where Rhaenyra, and this is the subtitle, you're to have a child.
Sequilat.
Sicagon means to give birth to. Sequilat is like in the future tense, and it's second person plural. And so basically it's like she's saying, you two are going to give birth. And she says to both of them in the same way, it'd be like a couple. It's like, oh, you're having a baby.
Yeah. So you two are expecting is what she's
basically
asking. Yeah. Yeah.
Basically. And then his response, like one day, it's not actually one day. It's, in a day in the future.
Razilari to me.
And so it's actually much, much less of a hedge than he does in English. It's very clear. Like when he says to you, you know, mazilare to be, it's like, I mean, at some point in time, we're gonna have a baby.
Yeah, it's possible. Right. Wow. Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah. So,
and it's like, it's just like it comes across a little differently. So it's like you already have a wife. It's like that one's pretty standard. It's just, you know, a wife already you have. His response is not one of my choosing. It's a best way to say that would be like, you know, the way that one that I have chosen. No.
Good.
That's fantastic. I love those little details. One last little thing and then I'll let you go. So, sure. All right. I'm imagining that when your process is that you will translate, then you'll record your voice, and then that recording will be delivered to the actors, right?
Yes.
And so they're mimicking you, right?
Yes.
Will they also get sort of a phonetic rendering of these words to make it easy to look at? Or do they just see the High Valyrian in the script?
Oh, no. I wouldn't say necessarily a phonetic rendering, but they have a syllable by syllable breakdown.
Okay. I was wondering about that. Yeah. Because I would imagine it's no small feat to actually be able to communicate with feeling some of these lines if you don't know which syllables to emphasize.
I will say it this way. I give them more information than they might use because every actor's process is different. And so I don't know what will be useful.
Right.
I know that everything that I give has been seen as useful for at least, you know, one actor. And so I'd rather give them more than they need.
Makes sense.
Every so often, it's something different. It was really interesting in this, in Dune, Timothy Chalamet, like I always record at full speed and then slow and then give the English. And he wanted all of his lines just the slow speed. and nothing else. It's not like
maybe he does this with everything. Maybe he like slows down podcasts so everyone sounds like they're drunk. He just prefers it that way.
Yeah, but you know, it's like, you know, it's like, all right, that's what's going to help you. Then great. I'm there for you, you know?
Hey man, I always appreciate our conversations. I always learn something that's fascinating and I know my listeners love it too. So I appreciate you coming on.
I am happy to be here. Thanks for having me again.